I've said it several times, and I'll say it again throughout the sermon series, that this first letter to the Corinthians is essentially a missionary manual. In every chapter, Paul has been hammering home the idea that this group of Christians in Corinth can actually become God's agent to reach out to the pagan world around them, that they will be missionaries, salt and light in a very dark world. But of course, of paramount importance to Paul is this idea that evangelism begins with a healthy church. Ever since the days when Jesus first gathered his own 12 disciples, the church was always designed to attract the world to God through a group of people radically committed to living out the life of God's kingdom on earth. The healthier that this community of believers was, the more attractional pull it would have amongst non-believers around it. And of course, the easier it would be for its members to invite non-believers to come and experience the fellowship of God's people as God's kingdom was experienced by all. And so, in actual fact, a healthy church, as Paul has always already said in chapter 3, a healthy church would be like a glorious temple built on the foundation of Jesus Christ with gold and silver and precious gems. And it would be glittering to the world, and the world would be attracted and come. Paul also says that a healthy church will be like a perfectly formed human body with every part functioning just as it was meant to be. Perfect harmony and balance. That too would be an attractional pull on the world as everyone did what, according to the head, Jesus Christ. Of course, this begs the question, what are the essential components that create a healthy church? If this is true, that a healthy church will attract the world to Jesus, how do we get a healthy church? And Paul has already told us quite a number of things. Is it, for example, the excitement of worship? Is it the oratory skills of the preacher? Is it the quality of the coffee? Is it the creative use of videos and smoke machines? What makes a healthy church healthy? Well, according to Paul, there are only two key components. First, a healthy church knows how to keep all the unhealthy influences at bay or quarantine them. So in a healthy church, unhealthy influences are quarantined. Second, to make a healthy church, God's love must fill every relationship. Now, it's this second aspect of love that we come to in chapter 13. So you can, as you see, Paul has been building his argument. What makes the community of God's people a missionary community? Get rid of all the unhealthy influences. So get rid of the problems in the church that are causing it to be less than attractive. Secondly, fill it with God's love. This is what this 13th chapter is all about. Let's open with the first lines. If I speak in the tongues of men or of angels but do not have love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, if I have faith that can move mountains but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardship that I may boast but do not have love, I gain nothing. This is a direct connection, of course, with chapter 12. In chapter 12, Paul has listed all the gifts that God has given to the church. The triune God, Father, Son, and Spirit have equipped his people to serve one another and thus help them grow in unity. What Paul wants us to recognize in chapter 13, however, is that these spiritual gifts cannot operate by themselves. They can only operate in love. And so Paul highlights the word if. If you have this gift but don't have love. If you have this gift but don't have love. If I have this gift but don't have love. In other words, the gifts do not function and are worthless without love. Jesus said the exact same thing already in Matthew chapter 7. In this passage, it's kind of a difficult one to understand. Jesus says, many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name or cast out demons in your name or perform many miracles? Didn't we use our gifts in your name? And Jesus responds, I'm sorry, but I never knew you. Depart from me, you evildoers. It's a bit perplexing. Why does Jesus call these people evildoers? And the only answer you can come up with is because although they use spiritual gifts from God, these gifts were misused. That is, they weren't used in the way that God had prescribed, that is, with love. They were disconnected from the overall purposes of love in Jesus Christ. In other words, a gift without love is less than useless. It can be, in fact, harmful. That's why Jesus calls them evildoers. For the overall purposes of God are always to seek and to save the lost. If you misuse your spiritual gift and don't use it in love, you're actually potentially chasing people away from the kingdom rather than drawing them towards it. Gifts may still bring immediate relief, could bring benefit to someone, but without love, the underlying motivating force has been lost, and the connection with the eternal significance of that gift and what it's meant to do has been lost. Therefore, says Jesus, it becomes evil. Let's go to verse 3. Consider this example. If I give all I possess to the poor, but have not love, I gain nothing. Let's pull this apart. Just imagine, God has given you the gift of generosity. And in line with that gift, he asks you to give everything away that you possess. That's wonderful. Remember, you have the gift of generosity, and that means that God has empowered you to be able to do this. It's not hard for you to do this. Of course, it's not a natural thing, but with the gift from God, it becomes possible. So what do? Well, you give all your money away to the poor. Great. It's easy. In the same way that speaking in tongues is easy for those who have the gift, right? But here's the question. Are you doing it from a heart of love? The second part of the verse. But have not love. You see, without love, you are in fact disconnected from what God really wants to do through your gift and through you. The gift has to be attached to the motivating force of love. Without love, in fact, you have no skin in the game. Without love, a measure of your heart's engagement, Paul says, you gain nothing. Now, this is a bit confusing. What do you mean, God, I don't gain anything? Well, in other words, you don't gain any sense of involvement in the cosmic purposes of God, which are the purposes of love. You see, the gifts are only there to contribute to God's overall purposes, to seek and to save the lost, to draw them into his kingdom, to love them forever. If you don't have love, then you're not connected to those eternal purposes, and therefore you will gain nothing. That is, you will gain no sense of union with Christ in his desire to heal the universe. You getting that? Let me give you another example. This is an example that Paul doesn't use, but I'm going to use it. Imagine that I have the gift of preaching. Okay, imagine. It might take a lot of imagination, but imagine, right? And imagine also that I preach without love. No love for you, no love for God, no love for the one who has given me this gift. Without love, what am I doing? Am I advancing the kingdom, really? I might get you to do things out of fear of my words, out of fear of my preaching. I might tell you that you're going to go to hell if you don't. But without love, it's worthless. Without love, it's evil. Do you know there have been a lot of ministers who have the gift of preaching? But they've cajoled their parish, their people into all sorts of things that in actual fact aren't out of love, but out of fear. Moreover, if Paul's correct, I gain nothing. I can preach with all sorts of eloquence, but if I preach without love, I gain nothing. That is, I won't gain the joy of seeing God at work in your lives, growing God's people and seeing God's kingdom expand. If we want our church to be united around Jesus, we all must use our gifts. However, if we use our gifts without love, then the whole project will backfire. And this is the problem in Corinth. Just imagine our own church. Can you imagine welcomers at the door welcoming you without love? Can you imagine Peter standing up and reading the Bible all for his own ego rather than because he wants you to hear the word well, because he loves you? Can you imagine playing the organ? I'm looking at two organ players here. But can you imagine playing the organ without love? Oh, look at me, look at me. Well, it doesn't help anybody, and the church will fold. Fortunately, let me turn to the NCLS results for our church. Good results. How well do you think we love each other? On a scale of 1 to 10. 9. Not bad, hey? In a section entitled Belonging and Involvement, 90% of you said that you have a strong sense of belonging here. That's love. 88% of you added that it's been easy for you to make friends here in our church. That's love. Furthermore, 47% of you said that you're involved in some sort of small group or Bible study or prayer group. What keeps you going? Back to the same groups. Love. Another 32% of you said that you spend time socially together in fellowship. What causes you to keep coming back to each other and meeting with each other and in other settings? Love. See, the beauty of the NCLS report tells me that we actually enjoy being God's people here. And if we enjoy God's people, then we exude love. And that means then that when you use your gifts, whether they be playing the organ or reading the scriptures or welcoming at the door or serving morning tea after church, whatever gift you use, you are using that gift in love. Of course, one of the hardest things to know, and in fact only you really know, what's your motivating factor? Why does Ken play the organ? Does he want us to applaud him? Or does he come out of love? I know he does. He's got his own church, you know. This is his second church home. And that's a beautiful thing that he comes out of love. But we don't know that unless we see the fruit of love in his actions. And that's probably why Paul continues and doesn't stop with verse 3. In verses 4 to 7, he finally describes what the motivating force of love looks like. What's the fruit of love? And this is what he says. Love is patient. Love is kind. Paul starts with two positive qualities of love, patience and kindness, both of which are extremely relational. You know, you can't practice patience by yourself. Imagine yourself on a desert island. Can you be patient? If you're patient for anything, it's patient waiting for someone to come. It's relational, always relational. You're patient because there's somebody else involved. When you're in traffic, and instead of beeping the horn, you're patient. That's love. Always relational. Kindness is always relational. To be patient is to wait for others, not to be pushy or overly demanding, to recognize where another person is in their own spiritual journey. Similarly, to be kind is go out of your way for the other person, recognizing that there are hurts and hardships that others face. People may be feeling left out or left behind. Ask yourself this question: am I patient and kind when I use my spiritual gifts? For example, when I preach, do I show patience and kindness towards you Or do I badger you and get impatient with you and push you to try to accept my way? Are my words kind to those who may be going through a difficult lifetime situation? Continuing on in verse 4, Paul shifts to a series of 8 negative items. The first two are positive, patience and kindness, but the next 8 are all negative. Love does not envy, Paul says. Now it's interesting in these next 8 negatives, they all correspond back to something already Paul has mentioned in the letter. So when he says in verse 4, love does not envy, this is the exact same word he's used already in chapter 3 when Paul asked the Corinthians, as long as there is jealousy, he says, envy, and quarreling among you, are you not living in the flesh? Paul's already mentioned envy. Here he mentions it again because he says love really does not envy. Love is the opposite of envy. The second negative, love does not boast. Paul has already repeatedly reminded the Corinthians how boasting destroys them. He's mentioned in chapter 1 and chapter 3 and chapter 4 and chapter 5, and now he mentions it in chapter 13. Love does not boast. The third negative description, love is not proud. Paul uses the exact same word he's used back in chapters 4 and 5 when he told the Corinthians about their selfish pride. Here, he puts it under the rubric of love. Love is not proud. The fourth negative description, found in verse 5, love is not rude. Now, this is a difficult Greek word, and it actually is unseemly. Love does not act in an unseemly manner towards the another. Paul's probably referring to the shameful behavior of that young man in chapter 5, if you remember, who was behaving rudely in relationship to his father's wife, in other words, his stepmother or mother-in-law. He would have also had in mind the rude behavior of the rich, mentioned in chapter 11, if you remember, who were behaving rudely towards the poor. They were eating and drinking and being merry while the poor were outside. Paul goes on, and the fifth item this time, found in verse 5, love is not self-seeking. This is precisely the same language that Paul used back in chapter 10 in response to that controversy over eating meat sacrificed to idols. Remember, Paul said, do not seek your own advantage, but that of the other. It's the same idea here. Love is not self-seeking. So what you can see in Paul's writing now, in chapter 13, he's reviewing the whole of the history of his relationship with the Corinthian church. He's going back over his letter and saying, don't you remember when I said this? Here's the summary. Love is not like that. Love operates differently than that. Your behavior, Paul is saying, contradicts and undermines the very character of God. The God who wants to draw the world to himself through you, but can't be seen because you do not love. Of course, it's St. John who said, God is love, and those who want to live in God must live in love. This is exactly the same idea that Paul is pulling out here in chapter 13. The next two negatives Paul lists are far more general, yet you can also see how they relate back to the letter he has already written. First, love, Paul says, is not easily angered. And finally, love keeps no record of wrongs. He's talking here about the factions, and Paul has already been dressing the factions of the Corinthians, those who say, I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, I follow Cephas. Well, Paul says, guess what? Love is not like that. You can't hold your factions and be separate from each other. You cannot base your factions in rivalries and dissension. Love is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs, so be reconciled to one another. Verse 6, Paul concludes by saying, love does not delight in evil. the word here in the Greek is injustice, but rejoices in the truth. The idea of injustice has already featured back in chapter 6. If you remember, the Corinthian Christians were taking each other to court, and Paul says, don't rejoice in injustice, in this fact that you've got one up on your brother, and you're taking them to court to strip them of their pride and to take their money as well. Paul says, love does not do that, but it rejoices in the truth. And the truth, of course, is the righteous living of God's people who forgive one another and are reconciled to one another in Christ. Well, I hope you've kind of made sense of that middle section of this chapter, because in actual fact, what Paul is doing is just repeating what he's been saying all along, but now condensing it and referring it all to this idea of love. The final section of chapter 13 is verses 8 to 13. And in this section, Paul moves in a slightly different direction. For now, he's going to contrast the permanence of love, the undergirding factor that holds the church together, with the transitory nature of these spiritual gifts that God has given only temporarily to the church. Paul starts off by saying love never fails. However, where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. In other words, if you're going to focus on anything, don't focus on the gifts. Focus on love, because this is the only thing that really lasts. And the rest of the passage accentuates the same idea. Paul goes on, for we know in part, we prophesy in part, but when completeness comes, that is the completeness of love, what is in part disappears. Paul goes on, when I was a child, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became an adult, I put these childish ways behind me. In other words, the frantic looking for a gift. Look at me, look at me. I've put those all behind me because I've finally understood that love is so much more important. For now, says Paul, we see only a reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. That is, now I know in part my gift of knowledge. I prophesy in part, my gift of prophecy, but then I will know even as I'm fully known. So all the gifts of the Spirit are temporary for the building up of the body in love. Ultimately, all those gifts will be left behind, and only love will last. And now these three things remain, says Paul, faith, hope, and love, but the greatest of these is love. In order to help you grasp a bit more better the intention of Paul here, let me ask you a question. Will there be spiritual gifts in heaven? Have you ever thought about that? Will we prophesy in heaven? Words of knowledge? Will there be apostles in heaven or pastors? How about workers of miracles? Here are all the gifts listed. Will any of these be in heaven? Well, no. It's interesting. All the gifts will cease because they will no longer be necessary when the Lord returns, when the fullness of His kingdom is finally present on earth. Every spiritual gift has only a temporary nature, for gifts are only suited to this world, to this time between the times, when the church of Jesus Christ is without the prophet Jesus. We are without the apostle Jesus. We are without the one who has all knowledge and all wisdom, Jesus. And in the meantime, He has given us these gifts as part of Himself to complete what is now lacking. He, the head, is in a sense not here with us, but using His gifts to help us complete what is missing. When the Lord Jesus returns, all will be complete, and we will then walk not by faith, we will walk by sight. For we will hear the words of knowledge and prophecy completed in Jesus Christ. He will be our pastor and teacher. He will lead us into the fullness of knowledge. and we will not need the gifts. Paul, in verse 10, makes it very clear. For when perfection comes, the imperfect disappears. The perfection that is coming is Jesus. And all the mucking about that we do right now, the imperfect use of our gifts, will finally disappear. And I say, hallelujah. Paul makes it very clear. And that's why love, to go back to the very first verse of today's passage, love is the more excellent way. That's what Paul's been showing us in chapter 13. As he says, I will now show you the more excellent way. And the more excellent way is the way that lasts forever. A way that will take us into eternity. In the present time, love undergirds the gifts. Love gives the gifts meaning and purpose. Love connects the gifts to the cosmic picture of Christ's salvation and His love for the world. And so it's only when love presides over our common church life that all these spiritual gifts find their rightful place and achieve the overarching purpose for which God gave them to us. The gifts, in a sense, bring eternity into the present. But you know, when we're finally in eternity, we won't need those gifts. Let me finish by giving you three lessons that I take away from this passage from 1 Corinthians 13. The first lesson is this. Love demands that we take a regular and honest self-evaluation. Do you stop and ask yourself questions like, why am I doing this? Like, I don't know, if you're handing out bulletins at the door, you're our welcomer for today. Have you ever asked the question, why am I doing this? I hope you just don't do it because you've been on the roster, right? Or do you? Yeah, you probably do. You see, if I don't stop myself and ask the question, why am I up here? Why am I here preaching? And if I can't answer the question, I preach out of love, then I should go home. I should retire early. Maybe that's a good idea. No, but you see how stupid it is if we take love out of the equation. So I want you to remember this lesson. When you come to this church to serve, and you can't say honestly you're doing it out of love, then please have another think. Self-evaluation is really important. Whether you're praying, whether you're reading the Bible, whether you're handing out bulletins, whether you're playing the organ, if you can't say you're doing it out of love, then you need to go back to Jesus. Because your gift is worthless without love. You gain nothing, and we gain nothing. Secondly, love requires the formation of our character. That means you can't stay the same. Love demands that you keep being changed. Verses 4 to 7 offer a picture of habitual actions and dispositions. Remember, we read through, this is what love is, this is what love isn't, this is what love does, this is what love doesn't do. Now, you might at this moment be kind of in the position of doing something that's not fully loving. Well, let God grow you. Let God change your character. That's what this is all about. Paul isn't saying to the Corinthians now, I want you to all go home. No, he says, okay, if you're not loving right now fully, then learn from where you are and let God change you, transform you, moving you. You know, it's interesting, but you can't decide in a day's time to start doing things in love. Love is in fact a learned behavior. It's cultivated by the Spirit over a long period of time. If you're not fully loving now, learn to love. Ask the Spirit to change. Always looking forward to a change of your character over time. I often use Berica as an example, but she's a brand new Christian. She was just converted last year. And we were talking last night. She says, I want God to change me now. I want to be perfect now, in other words. And I said, well, look, wouldn't that be lovely? But it doesn't work that way. Do you ever see a piece of fruit appear on a tree fully ripened? That would be a miracle. But why doesn't God do it that way? Because we're hungry, aren't we? Why doesn't he just produce apples that are already ripe? No. It's all about time and about patience and about growing and about changing. Love is a learned behavior. And that's why we're here on earth. We learn how to love. We learn how to grow. We learn how to be a community. Thirdly, and finally, love calls us to be extremely humble with our gifts. This is why Paul says, you know, we know in part and we prophesy in part. That means whatever gift you have, you're using it only on the basis of incomplete information. We have no choice because we're not perfect yet, so we only know in part. And so what we do is done in part. In other words, as Paul says, we live in a time of shadows. The mirror that we look in is a bit blurred. So the force of these verses is to encourage us to have a sense of humility in the gifts that we're using. And to laugh sometimes when we make mistakes. You know, Ken might hit the wrong note. Well, let's humor him. You know, nobody's perfect, right? And when you hand out bulletins and you make a mess of I don't know how you can make a mess of handing out a bulletin. But if you read the Bible and you can't say Nebuchadnezzar, right? Well, who cares? We're using our gifts. That's the main thing. And you're learning how to use them humbly. That's what it's about. You know, when I first came here 20 years ago, there was a man who used to read the Bible. I'm going to use this as an illustration. He used to read the Bible. But I knew his son. And the son said, you know, my dad, he's not really a Christian. He just reads the Bible because he loves to be seen. Now, I don't know how his son could have actually, you know, evaluated that. But that's sad. He was a prideful man who wanted to be seen. Well, that's what this third lesson is pointing out. If you come to be seen and you use your gifts just to be seen, you've mistaken the reason why God has given you a gift. We are here humbly, in our boots of humanity, and those boots are sometimes heavy and they slow us down, and we're all feeble and frail and we fail, but that's okay. We use our gifts nonetheless, but we use them in love. You see, the priority here, as always, is love. It's only the only thing that will last, but it's the only thing that truly identifies us now as the children of God. Do you remember what Jesus said? By this, we'll all know that you are my disciples. If you have these amazing spiritual gifts, if you prophesy and speak in tongues and have light shows and smoke machines and the most amazing band on stage and praise music that's... No. Jesus said, by this we'll all know that you're my disciples. If you have love, the most basic but yet the most essential thing in the universe. Why? Because that's who God is. God is love. So in a sense, Jesus is saying, by this we'll all know that you're my disciples, if they can see Jesus standing in your midst, he who is love, generating, motivating love in your midst. As I said, the book of 1 Corinthians is a missionary manual. And here's the greatest missionary strategy of them all. In fact, it's the only strategy, I think, that God has given us. The strategy is love. Love each other. And through each other, love a lost world. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit.